And welcome to episode 62 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
True crime is one of Hollywood's most successful genres. Most recently, Netflix aired a 10-part series about Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee serial killer who killed 17 men and boys. It was a huge hit. But many of those who were affected by the crime were upset that they weren't consulted about the show, and they aren't interested in watching it. The sister of one of Dahmer's victims said it's sad that the producers are making money off the tragic events that happened more than three decades ago. Rick, why do you think so many people find such disturbing stories so interesting?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, because I think as long as there's been storytelling about kind of the horrific, about, you know, things that frighten us. I think part of us is simply drawn towards the monstrous. If we're living in a society, we're living in the context where we're always being required to repress many of our urges. And there's a curiosity. What would it be like to give in to those urges, not to have any of that repression? And yet, at the same time, we really don't want to live in a society where everybody gives into those urges. It really would not just scary, it would be downright dangerous and deeply unsettling. And so stories allow us both to, in our imagination, give in to the urges and eliminate the repression and kind of imagine what that's like, but also have the satisfaction of knowing that those who do such things get punished. And that's part of the storytelling, you know, especially with true crime stories, is to pretty much always find the criminal and punish, they get punished.
You know, we started off this episode by talking about the Jeffrey Dahmer series on Netflix. And full disclosure, I wasn't really planning on watching that series. But last week, I came down for the first time. And since we've had COVID, I was like one of the last people to finally get COVID. And that meant I ended up on the couch for a few days, not feeling the best. And knowing this show was coming up, I figured, well, at least I'll watch the first episode and you know, maybe I'll watch the first two. And partially because I didn't feel like doing a whole lot else over the couple of days, I made it through all 10 episodes. I mean, I think it was well done, and it did an okay. I think it did a better than okay job of sort of trying to get a look and explain why he did what he did. But as I was watching it, I kept thinking to myself, would this show have been as interesting if it would have been entirely fictionalized? If this was just created out of some writer's imagination? And I just don't think it would be. And I think the reason is part of the, I mean, I certainly wasn't am not even still an expert on the case, but it's sort of, you sort of have a small idea about what happened going in. And kind of getting a look inside that story and trying to figure out why someone would do something so incomprehensible is probably, I think, to me and a lot of people, why it's more interesting than just watching true fiction. Or true fiction's an oxymoronic term, but just watching fiction.
Yeah, I think, so you hit on two things there that I think are part of what's compelling about true crime. One is this feeling that this is just a normal person who could be my neighbor next door. And there's kind of something kind of frightening about that. In addition to, you know, fiction, it's easy to say this could never happen. With true crime, you know that it did. And so then it could again. And so then there's an extra element of kind of danger or suspense in the watching of it. And then there's the imagination of, you know, what is it like? And even you can tell by the titles of many of these serials that are broadcast, you know, like it's Dahmer-Monster. Like, you're like, how does a real person become a monster? And then, you know, that hit show, I Am a Killer, you know, like it invites you to go in to imagine what it's like. And I think there's a tendency to think that there's some access to the mysterious. There's something that people like Jeffrey Dahmer know. There's some insight into the world. There's some access to evil, which is kind of mysterious and intriguing that normal people don't have. And I think that's entirely false, but it is fed by the fictions of, you know, characters like Hannibal Lecter and Silence of the Lambs and others, you know, where there's, you know, like where the FBI keeps going back to him because he has an insight into other criminals. Right. And this is, you know, it's actually false. I mean, what you have in people like Jeffrey Dahmer is just a lack. There's a deep emptiness in them. Their lives are not led forth by meaning, to access to any kind of meaning. It's a life that's driven by urges. And because it's driven by urges, there's no insight to be had, but there are certain things that they're feeling, of course. But it's I think the Hannibal Lecter series at all is very misleading. And it's in some ways kind of a twisted wishful thinking that there's some kind of meaning in evil that simply isn't there.
No, you it sounds like you've not watched this Dahmer series on Netflix. Am I correct?
No, and I am not for a couple of reasons that we'll get into. I don't like the exploitation part of, you know, of victims' families. I won't support shows like that. But also I'm really not drawn to true crime. I love mysteries. I love mystery shows, fictionalized. I'm not drawn to true crime.
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm not typically that drawn to it. And I guess part of the reason I watch again was I knew we were going to be talking about it on our show. And I also knew that it was just sort of the show a lot of people were talking about. And I had a lot of time to kill, quite frankly. But one thing that was interesting, and you just touched on it, though, is that as the sort of in the later episodes of the show, there are people who are writing books about this, including Jeffrey's father, Lionel, who was portrayed by Richard Jenkins in the series. And I thought, quite frankly, was in from an acting standpoint, the star of the show. They even talked about in the miniseries about how it's wrong for people to profit on crime such as this, which was interesting because, of course, you couldn't help but watch the show and think that this show was doing exactly that. The other thing I guess a little better in my mind was that sort of the underlying theme was how often there were signs that this could have been stopped a lot sooner, how often mistakes were made, especially by law enforcement, where this could have been stopped a lot sooner, where people like Jesse Jackson came into Milwaukee, and this was all, a whole episode was sort of devoted to this, and talked to the neighbors who kept calling police again and again and again, and nothing was done. So, I mean, I'm not sure that excuses some of the, quite frankly, the gross aspects of the show, which I think you could probably imagine, but it did touch on some of those points too. But I would just love to know and be in that TV writing room in a way of how you talk about people in the show saying how it's wrong to exploit and make money off tragic events like this when you're writing for a show that in many ways is exploiting and making money off terrible events just like that.
Well, I think the show's creators are just disingenuous. They want to build into the show itself like some awareness. They know the criticism that it's getting, and they want to ease their conscience. So they write in, you know, ways of kind of some kind of social justification and awareness of it. But it's, face it, it's the whole reason for the show is because it's going to make a lot of money for Netflix, and it's going to make a lot of money by being exploitative. And if it wasn't that, if it were, you know, proposed because it was going to serve some kind of social function but not get a lot of viewers, it wouldn't be made.
Now, you mentioned that you're not a fan of true crime. I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, you are a fan of maybe what I'll call old school horror films. Is that right?
Yeah, and I'm a kind of a classic movie buff anyway, and I really like especially the Universal studios horror films of the 30s and 40s.
So how, I mean, having not seen Dahmer, but I think you get a sense of what that was like. How are those different in a lot of ways than either true crime shows like that we see today or other sort of over the top tellings of gory things?
First of all, it's brilliant filmmaking. Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Invisible Man were all directed by James Whale, who was just a brilliant director who kind of could mix horror and kind of camp, real comedy in them, and with brilliant dialogue and then kind of a social commentary, observations about, you know, like what's permitted and what's forbidden in society. And then some real kind of insights into human nature. I mean, that's the brilliance of a story like Frankenstein is, Mary Shelley's book. It sees the Frankenstein's monster is the Cass is this creature who is in some ways supposed to be perfect, but then is not loved and is rejected. And what happens to a person who, mainly because of their outward person, is not given love, who's rejected in several ways? Well, they become monsters. They're like, this is actually what happens. You get this with people like Ted Kaczynski. I mean, it's pretty well known. Like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, he was very sick as a young child, and then was isolated in hospital and kind of not permitted to have any human contact. And his family talks about how his personality then just changed. He became really withdrawn. And so you get this over and over where something happens. Sometimes it's biological, but oftentimes it's what happens within families to make somebody reject others. If they can't have love, they're going to create pain. So that's a theme of a story like Frankenstein. And then I just want to stop for a second, though, on that.
We all know, and I think anybody watching Frankenstein knows that's not based on a true story. Right. But is that somehow make it, how does that make it better, I guess, than telling us? I mean, maybe there's been a movie about Ted Kaczynski. I'd be surprised if there hasn't been. I don't know. There's certainly, this is not the first Dahmer movie. There's certainly other Ted Bundys and all these other serial killers have had shows and movies made about them. I guess I'm not clear by what you're saying why it's maybe okay to tell the morality play about a character like Frankenstein, but not about a real life person.
I like the classic horror movies as a very occasional entertainment. And I think that oftentimes some of those stories, what the stories that they're based on, kind of tap into kind of a deep mythology, the Dracula vampire story is another kind of into a mythology about our desires and the ultimate emptiness of our desires. And what is it like to live a life devoid of meaning, but driven by urges? And how that's kind of a living death to live out one's life in that way. So I think that's what I like about the kind of the classic horror stories and some of the movies that were made, especially in the 30s and 40s about them, and even some more contemporary ones. But the key is that they're a very occasional entertainment. What I find really disturbing about the kind of contemporary true crime phenomenon is that it's really driven by binge watchers.
Like I was over the last few days.
Yeah. And I think this creates a really distorted perception, because we know that our personalities are profoundly influenced by the people that we spend time with. But it's not just the people, it's our social context. And so if our social context is one of this, of binge watching lots of true crime, and there are people that, you know, go from podcasts to shows, you know, to magazines or books, they go from one to the other, you end up with a really distorted view of what people are like and what society is like. So it's the volume of it that I don't like about kind of this contemporary true crime phenomenon.
And just to kind of stretch that thread out a little more, that topic was one you wrote your column about, and we'll certainly link to that in the show notes. But you're saying that when people sort of overdose on those topics, that it really distorts their perception and but also can lead to more societal problems, you say as well. Is that right?
Well, yeah, it's pretty well known right now that people all over the country have thought, you know, for the past 20 years, have really been convinced that crime rates have been rising. Well, they did rise quite sharply during the pandemic. They've been coming back down again, but they've been on a 30-year decline. But most people don't believe that, and they don't believe it because of what they're watching. And partly that's the news, but then, the news, especially TV news, oftentimes leads with, you know, stories of violence. And of course, we're drawn to the spectacle, but what this does is it distorts our perception of what's really going on. Well, then, if we really believe that the solutions we've created as a society are not working to keep us safe, we're going to be compelled to seek even more kind of restrictive kind of laws and vote for more extreme politicians and actually end up making things worse than they are right now.
And it sounds like you're somewhat agnostic whether people are coming across that in TVs, movies, books, podcasts. I mean, I think different formats appeal to different people for different reasons, but you don't necessarily think that. I guess maybe I'll ask it this way. I mean, back it was in 1966 before you saw a lot of this, especially on TV and in as graphic details as we see today. Truman Capote wrote a widely known book called In Cold Blood that detailed the murder of the family of four in Kansas. And is that seem different to you somehow in the written word than seeing something graphically portrayed on your TV screen or in the movie theater?
Yeah, quite a bit different because with the written word, it's not spectacle. Now, it's spectacle in one sense. It's descriptive. It kind of paints a picture of what's going on, and Capote did that like really vividly and. Is amazing piece of writing, but it's also, it kind of stands alone. So you take that, you have all your ordinary social experience, you're hanging out with your friends, you're doing all these things, and then you spend a couple hours reading In Cold Blood, and then you go back to all these other things which normalize your experiences. The same thing like with a writer like Patricia Highsmith, who wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley, and then did a series of it was about the sociopath, Tom Ripley, which I thought were quite brilliant. They invite you in more of a reflective mode to really think about what's going on. And so instead of just being captivated by the images, you spend time kind of imagining what this is like, what the experience is like, both for the perpetrator, for the victim, but then come back into the real world. And the key thing is that most of our sensibilities should be shaped by our association with, I would say, like good people, people who are drawn towards meaning. And most of our attention, for proper kind of moral development, our lives must be drawn towards a pursuit of some kind of meaning for us to have what any of us would consider a good life. We can't spend a very large part of our time just in diversions or entertainments or spectacle, because what it does is it kind of keeps us going. It keeps our attention focused, but it doesn't advance us in any way. It doesn't help us make deeper, more meaningful social connections.
So not to spend this entire show talking about my TV habits as I recovered from COVID, but after I got done watching Dahmer and still had time to kill, there was another show that I watched, and there's an odd connection. Both are produced by Ryan Murphy, who has done lots of TV work, including Dahmer, but he also did a show that came out just exactly about a year ago. It's called, and it's a series he does for FX called American Crime Story. And the first one was about the O.J. Simpson case. The second one was about the murder of Versace. The third one that I watched this last week was about the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And I mean, that was a, there was, you know, and it was set up as from a crime standpoint, but certainly not the horrific crime that Dahmer was. It was just, it was obviously a lot different. And what was interesting about that, I thought, impeachment show that Ryan Murphy put out for FX a year ago, one of the producers was Monica Lewinsky, who clearly played a central role in that show. And in that, well, not in the show, but also in real life. And I thought it actually, I thought it was better TV than the Dahmer one was. But it was, and I guess because Monica Lewinsky was a producer, I think it, as best I could tell, showed her in an honest light, but I think really made us as a society sort of rethink how we framed up that story in the late 90s. And it went to examples from real life late night shows, how everybody just felt making jokes about Monica Lewinsky and her actions then was just fine, and kind of giving then President Clinton a pass. And it is interesting to see how, I think in many good ways, how far we've come on that. But again, so maybe I'm trying to draw a parallel here, maybe where there's not a direct one, but walking away from watching that show, which I guess you could loosely call a true crime show, but it really, I think, made me rethink that important era in our country and in our politics, and I think gave the proper perspective that was probably lacking at that time.
Yeah, and I think there's real merit in doing that. For one thing, the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky scandal was, I mean, it was everywhere. It had a profound effect on our country, on the way we see the presidency. You know, it was covered everywhere. And so we all have this kind of perception of what happened because it was being covered by all these different media for a long period of time. Then to go back and revisit that in a way that presents a kind of coherent narrative of all the events and ties them together with some perspective on it, I think is, yeah, that's quite valuable. And I don't see that being exploitative in the same way that many of the true crime dramas like the Jeffrey Dahmer or I Am a Killer, some of these others are. One of the reasons that these networks keep producing the shows and podcasters keep doing series is that the news stories can't be copyrighted. I mean, they're presenting facts. And so there's no royalties to pay to an author. You don't have to get permission. Anybody can just pick up those stories and make their own show about it. And you've got this material that is just waiting for people to do something with. And there's no need even to get permission of the victims' families. And that's a real shame.
I mean, I know there in an interview I read with Kim Goldman, whose brother Ron was killed alongside Nicole Brown Simpson back in 1994 and has become a victim rights advocate since then. She says TV producers rarely consult with families. And I don't think, and she probably realized in the interview that this would be a tough law to write, but she thinks that it would be great if you could somehow craft legislation that really requires that. I mean, I hear that and think that just kind of goes up against our basic First Amendment and free speech rights. I don't know what your thoughts are.
I don't see how it would be enforceable. How do you write such a law? Like which family members and
how do you define victim?
How do you find do you define victim and who has to sign off? What if they disagree?
Yeah.
So I mean, there are a lot of things in our society that we can say are, you know, morally right or morally wrong that we don't pass laws regarding. And I think this is one of them. And I think there is an injustice being done, but I'm not really an advocate of the kinds of laws that Kim Goldman is proposing.
Before we close on this segment, of course, we just had Halloween a couple days ago. And around a week or two before Halloween happened, there were some news stories about how some online marketplaces and probably other places, maybe real live stores, were stopping sales of Dahmer themed costumes. Of course, as we said before, Dahmer's in the news right now, even though it's a 30-year-old case because of this Netflix show. Do you think it's I guess how and what level of inappropriateness do you think it is to have stores selling Jeffrey Dahmer themed costumes?
I have mixed feelings on this. I hate to see a society that's overly restrictive. I don't think it's appropriate. I'm not sure there should be laws against it. I don't, you know.
I don't know if anybody was suggesting that you should outlaw the sale of it, but I think these stores feeling pressure from
customers
or just the online zeitgeist were pulling these off.
I think that's fine. You mean if people are thinking like that's just not right. I don't feel good about it. I don't want to support stores that are profiting off of that. That's, you know, good for them. And, you know, stores are the best judge if they want to pull it off. But the other thing is, it depends on whether the costumes are for kids or for adults. Yeah. You know, so if it's an adult Halloween party, you know, and somebody comes up, he shows up in a Jeffrey Dahmer costume, I would think it's kind of funny.
So you would be okay. So if that was going to be my next question. So you think that would be okay?
I wouldn't do it. But yeah, I would. Yeah. I wouldn't mind if I was hosting a Halloween party and you showed up in a Jeffrey Dahmer costume. I would think it's kind of funny.
And had like a bucket with a severed arm sticking out at the side.
Yeah. I mean, it would, you know, Yeah, that would be fine. But the not for kids.
Okay.
I don't think you should have 9 or 10 year olds right, dressed up like Jeffrey Dahmer. And this is partly going back to one of the things I wrote about is, a couple thousand years ago, when Plato wrote The Republic, he had proposed banning storytellers from the ideal society. And one reason is that especially youth are really especially drawn to the spectacle. And it's easier to portray what's interesting about bad conduct than what's interesting about good conduct. Because bad conduct is kind of, in a way, immediately exciting. It's often violent, it's action-oriented, and it produces all kinds of reactions. And so there's an immediate interest that kids can get. Good behavior has to be experienced from the inside, and it takes a while to figure out, like what is attractive about doing something that's meaningful, behaving in a way that's meaningful. And so it takes a period of time in which you're associating with other good people, imitating them, and develop kind of habits and a certain kind of sensibility. And he says there's a danger in which kids are in the context of too much bad spectacle and that they don't develop the right kinds of sensibilities. And that's, you know, why I'm just cautious about, I guess, the way in which we're raising so many of our kids in a kind of very visually oriented environment with lots of bad, violent images constantly around them. I think it's a really hard time to grow up in this society.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Well, Scott, it's just a few days after Halloween now, and I don't know if I know you live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of kids that are going trick-or-treating. We always buy lots of candy and put it out, and then we're inevitably left over. You have a lot of leftovers. And there's this dilemma that my wife and I always have, and it answered differently depending on who buys the Halloween candy. Like, what do you buy and how much? And so, and also, like, how do you hand them out? So I'm kind of a fan of just sticking a bowl out and letting the kids choose themselves. But then you see some kids pick big handfuls out, and others will just take one. My wife likes to go out there and interact with the kids a little more than I do, and then like hand each one the same amount. So I want to start with that. Do you trick or treating, and do you like, is it important to ensure that everybody gets the same amount, or do you just let them go?
So a couple of things. So we've been in this house for about 10 Halloweens now, and the entire time, there is some of our best neighbors who live not directly across the street, but almost across the street, have one of our city's biggest Halloween displays. So we're like, oh my gosh, we're just going to get flooded with kids. So the first year we got candy and we were all ready to go. And what happened was all the kids were so drawn to this, our neighbor's incredible Halloween display across the street, they never crossed the street to come to us. and we're not on a busy street otherwise. So I think everybody kind of went over and saw this big display and then just kind of went another direction. So after, I don't know if it was 1 or 2 years of this, we just decided, I had never really been in a situation because I lived in apartments and condos where you don't really have to worry about this sort of stuff. So the first year I was like all excited. We're going to hand out candy. It's going to be great. And then I don't know. I quickly decided that it sounded a lot more fun than it was. So we are the grumpy folks on the block who once trick or treating hour grows near, we close the curtains and turn off all the outside lights and hope everybody continues on down the street and we don't hand out anything. Now, you bring up a point is, you know, could we just, we have, you know, get a big plastic bowl, fill it with whatever candy and set it outside? I suppose we could. That never really occurred to me. It would be kind of an interesting experiment to see how quickly it goes or if you have any leftovers. I don't know. And maybe, I guess I might consider trying that. I honestly don't know in our city or our neighborhood, do people do that very often?
Yeah, quite a few do.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Especially maybe if you're a family who goes, maybe have young kids and you're going out trick or treating with them, so you just leave the candy behind.
Sometimes I'll be out when it's really busy, when there's a lot of kids coming by, I'll be out there with it and I'll hand out some candy. Other times where I'm doing something, I'll put a bowl out for a while. I have to run inside cooking dinner or something like that. And I'm just kind of keeping an eye on it. It's fascinating to see, like with families, you have older brothers and sisters talking to the little ones and they'll tell them like, now just take one, you know, and you see real differences in children's behaviors. Like some are looking around and just grabbing handfuls and putting in their little bags and running off to the next house. And others are looking through very carefully to pick out which kind of candy they like most, but just making sure to take one and saying thank you. I find that fascinating just to see the differences in behavior.
Well, because you're a better Halloween participant than I am, I'll ask a couple of questions back to you. I mean, also you live in a busier street than I do, so it doesn't surprise me to hear that you get a few more kids. But so when you're making that candy, do you buy that? Does your wife buy the candy? Who makes that decision, or does it just sort of vary year to year?
It varies year to year. Usually she does, but I do sometimes.
And I mean, do you get something that you enjoy or that maybe you hope that you don't enjoy too much, or how do you decide what to, and I guess does the health factor play into it at all? I guess there's not any such thing as real healthy candy.
Well, I mean, some people want to give out like fruit packs or
that's true.
Little snack things. We just give candy. There's only I don't like very much candy, but I like Kit Kat bars and little Reese's cups. So I usually get those, which I like, but I also know the kids like them.
Yeah.
It always bothered me when I was a kid, there would be people that would give out Butterfingers and things like that, which, you know, I didn't know anybody who liked them. And I think the adults liked them, and that's why they handed them out, so they'd have them for leftovers. And that always struck me as being immoral. Maybe that's where I went into ethics.
That's right. Yeah.
For trick-or-treating.
And I probably would pick a candy maybe that kids, I don't know what kind of candy kids like, but I'm not a huge candy bar guy, but if I had to pick one, it would be like a Heath bar. And that doesn't strike me as like any kids' top 10 candy, but maybe I'm wrong.
That's probably why they didn't come to your place.
It might be.
You got the reputation for handing out mini Heath bars.
And you have this extravaganza across the way. It makes the decision pretty easy. So, well, I hope you had a good Halloween this year.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always good. I had students over I teach a class every Monday night. So it happened to be on Halloween night. And so it was it's fun to have students over to my house, and they enjoyed participating in handing out candy.
Well, I'm glad you do it. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Chris Lay is Lee's podcast operation manager. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.